Hi everyone, Davinia here, and this season of Let's Make It Rain, the podcast, is sponsored by PensionBee, an online pension provider who's on a mission to make pensions simple so that customers all over the UK can become pension confident and save for a happy retirement. PensionBee's website and app make it simple for customers to combine their old pension pots, contribute flexibly, and withdraw their pension money all in one place. PensionBee offers a range of pension plans for a range of different needs, whether you're self-employed or want to invest responsibly with a fossil fuel-free or impact investing plan. Head to pensionbee.com or download the app to get started and become pension confident. Remember, as with all investing, your capital is at risk. And speaking of investing, for lots of us, we didn't start learning about how to save, spend, and invest our money for the future until we were well into our adulthood. I wrote Cash is Queen to change that. Cash is Queen is the world's first financial literacy book written exclusively for preteen and teenage girls, equipping them with everything they need to build solid financial foundations long before they start their first jobs. Buy it for your daughters, your nieces, your granddaughters, your goddaughters, and even yourselves. Link in show notes to find out more. Enjoy the episode. Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers. Those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by Jo Wimble-Groves. Jo is a tech entrepreneur, author of the brilliant book Rise of the Girl, and blogger at Guilty Mother. Jo, thank you so much for being here with us today. Can you introduce yourself for the benefit of the listeners?
Hi, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast. So yes, my name is Jo. I am a tech entrepreneur. I run a family business with my brother, which is called Active Digital. And primarily, we're a mobile phone company. So, you know, we started all back in the 1990s when mobile phones were becoming a big thing. And it's a business that served us very well. So I love being a woman in tech. And I also realize how important the STEM industry has become for women and girls. And I'm sure we'll come on to talk about that a bit more. So I've realized that these sort of nearly 30 years of being in my industry, I'm really working hard to sort of share what I know and pull down the ladder and pass it down the line. I am a mum of three. I have a daughter who's 13, an 11-year-old son and a 3-year-old son. So I'm a busy mum, which I absolutely love. Organized chaos, we like to call it, as I'm sure as lots of listeners would relate to. And a couple of years ago, I became an international author, which I'm extremely proud of. I wrote a book called Rise of the Girl, 7 Empowering Conversations to Have with Your Daughter. And really, it was considering what I was like as a young woman and as a teenager. And it took me a long time to find my own voice and a true sense of self. And then having a daughter, particularly firstborn, I really wanted to think about how I was raising her, what conversations we were having at the kitchen table, and how we could pass that on to other people and hope that it might be useful. And particularly writing a book as a woman and as a parent, not as a doctor or a psychologist or anything particularly fancy, but just stripping back all the layers and what are the conversations that I have at my kitchen table that might help other parents, or just people that have a daughter in their life, such as a niece, a goddaughter, a friend's daughter, just someone that's reaching out to say, look, raising girls in a modern world is pretty challenging. You know, what can we do to help them? And on from that, I'm also a speaker, and I really love going into schools and universities to share my journey and what I've learned along the way. So from sort of primary school upwards, I just love to talk to young people about how I became an entrepreneur, but I was a typical C grade student at school, tried really hard, didn't go to university, but still was able to make my own world of success. So, you know, as I say, in a nutshell, that's me trying to do quite a lot, but equally, hopefully trying to do something for the power of good.
Oh my gosh, Joe, I love that so much. It's almost like a keynote speech in like 60 seconds. That was absolutely brilliant. And as you were speaking, I was thinking to myself, I mean, you made a point about, you know, writing a book through the lens of a parent and as a woman, and therefore knowing some of the experiences, some of the feelings and emotions that you would have had to grapple with as a young girl, some of the experiences. And of course, you know, young girls today, their experiences are vastly different from yours or mine would have been, because, of course, we've got this digital world, social media, and the pressures that come from that as well. And I am a personal owner of the book. For anybody listening, it's fantastic. I bought it when I was saying to Joe before we started recording that I bought it when I had my first daughter, and it's really become something that we refer back to time and time again, particularly now that daughter is now 9 years old and so on the cusp of puberty and all of those sorts of things. So I'm about to enter into what I imagine will be quite a tricky time, just reflecting back on my own personal experiences as a girl, and the book has just been a really nice guide to some of those conversations that do crop up. And exactly as you say, it's far more relatable having it discussed from the perspective of another parent, somebody that you can relate to and who is having to deal with some of the feelings and maybe that helplessness or uncertainty that we have as mothers. But Joe, there are so many things that you do. And I, you know, as I shared, I was familiar with you from the perspective of Guilty Mother and the perspective of Rise of the Girl, not so much your tech background, which is really interesting because, of course, you entered into the industry and were a tech entrepreneur before it was glamorous, before it was sexy, before it was before there was any talk really about promoting greater gender diversity in STEM. And you've managed to, you know, combine all of these different interests. I mean, the question that I'd originally wanted to ask you was about how you manage all of the different things. But before we get to that question, I suppose my interest is in, you know, when you think about your experience in tech and built, and I love the fact that it's a family business as well. I'm a huge proponent and advocate of, you know, intergenerational wealth creation in families and legacy. But I'm just thinking about your tech background in mobile. And then you exploring some of your creativity, your writing through blogging, through writing a book, and of course as a mum as well. And one of the things that it strikes me is that when I was a teenager and thinking about which path I would pursue professionally, and you go and see your careers advisor, you're never really, I mean, maybe it was different in the late 90s and early 2000s, but we were never really encouraged to pursue multiple different paths, I think. I feel like this generation now, they're far more comfortable with this idea of having multi-hyphenate careers, as they're referred to. Where did you get that drive and I suppose that confidence to feel like, yes, I'm building this tech business, but also I'm interested in blogging over here and I'd like to write a book and now I'm a public speaker? Where did that come from?
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting question. And it's one of the reasons why I really enjoy going in and speaking to young people. Because I think you're right. When you're 16, 17 years old, for many of us, we don't know what we want to do. And actually, we feel quite a bit of anxiety around that. And as adults, we recognize this now. So many adults will come up to them, whether they're aunties, uncles, or friends, and say, what do you want to do when you're older? And they feel this immediate pressure, like you're supposed to have an answer. But if you don't know what you want to do, if you're not going to be a doctor or a vet or a teacher, or, you know, if you don't have it mapped out, like I didn't, I think it can feel quite stressful. So I actually tried to make a point not to ask too many young people what they want to do, because I like to find out, or maybe rephrase the question to ask about their interests, what fuels their passion, what makes them feel good about themselves, and come from a completely different angle. And, you know, telling young people that it's okay if you don't have it all mapped out, they really appreciate hearing that. So how I sort of started out in my sector is quite an interesting story. So, yeah, I'd love to share it with you. So when I was in secondary school, yeah, we didn't really have many people talking about careers at all. But there was two things that I just felt that I was good at school. I don't know if people even said that I was good at it, but I felt inside me that I was quite good, which was A, drama. Love dramatic art, love being on the stage. I got an A for drama. I had the Lambda exams. I passed with honours, 96%. And I just loved, if there was a lead role, I would put my hand up and I will take that. And, you know, I got a bit of a reputation for myself around my friends is, you know, Joe wants to lead. If there's a funny part, I'm happy to make a fool of myself and be expressive, you know, and enjoy it. And I think there was lots of stress relief from being in the creatives and being theatrical and not being judged. So I really enjoyed drama. And I remember
I got a lovely sort of letter from my teacher when I left. My parents divorced at 15. I actually missed some of my GCSE exams because everything was just really upside down at school. But I do remember my drama teacher writing to me saying that I was really talented and she hopes that I would go far with my drama. I would love to find her. You know how sometimes you think? She seemed quite old, but she wasn't, because she was probably in her early 30s, but to us.
I know.
She was like really old. I mean, she might have got married, she might have gone off, I don't know. But I'd love to say thank you sometimes to these teachers that really support you when you're
shout
going
out
through
to
a
that
rough
teacher.
Time. Yes. You know, I was living away from home. My mum and dad were in a really bad place. Things were very disruptive at home. That, of course, is going to affect your school life. But we didn't have that pastoral care back then. And you all know that too. You know, there wasn't someone you could go and talk to. It was all very, very quiet. I doubt if the school even knew that I was struggling, to be honest. The second thing that I felt I was really good at was English. I love writing. I really enjoyed English literature as well, and reading about Jane Eyre and all these different stories. And again, it was a bit of reading was an escapism, but also writing lots of stories. And I've been writing stories since I was about 10. And I think those two things, if I could sort of bottle them and think, do those two, you know, studies really shape the characteristics of who Jo is? And it wasn't until much later that I could actually explore that creative side of me, which is so different to the tech world, isn't it? And it's interesting that after all my time in tech, that I actually found myself on the stage, but for a completely different reason. You know, I was on the stage doing my keynote speaking. So actually, Miss Waters was right. I did keep going on the stage, and I did make it on the stage, but just in a very different way. And then obviously becoming an author is an absolute dream come true. But when I was at school, again, 16, 17 years old, finished my GCSEs, mixed bag of results, but did okay. Really wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I was definitely at that crossroads that we were just talking about. And my brother, who's 4 years older than me, offered me, I would say, a little bit of a lifeline, really. He was at a crossroads in his own personal career. He was playing golf for England boys at the time, very, very talented golfer. Had a car accident, nothing major, but was injured and couldn't play golf to the standard that he was used to playing at. And he decided to start selling mobile phones, which I know sounds a bit of a strange thing to be doing, but started selling mobile phones and pretty much asked me if I wanted to help him out. And I took a bit of a leap of faith, to be honest with you, and I put my hand up and sort of took an opportunity to work with my brother. I think a lot of people thought, you know, what are you doing? Might seem like a bit of a strange thing to do, but my brother just thought getting into mobile phones in the mid to early 1990s seemed like a good thing to get into. And you know, from starting a business with not much at all, we have done really, really well. And, you know, fast forward some 27 years, we now turn over in excess of sort of 7 million. We employ about 25 people. We're one of the top performing partners for Virgin Media O2 across the entire UK and Ireland. And we are one of only 9 direct Apple partners. From very humble beginnings. We sell about 13 different products now. So yes, we started with the humble mobile phone. And, you know, anybody that you know, they do love their iPhones and their iPads. And so we sell everything Apple, but equally, we also do broadband and VoIP phone systems, and we develop apps and lots of different things that we do. I'm always grateful for the opportunity. And what if I hadn't have put my hand up to take a chance? You know, these things shape you, don't they? And, you know, I'm so pleased now that tech has become my world, really, and was my first baby, really. But then I was able to think about those things I really enjoyed at school. And, you know, later on, I was able to really explore that creative side of me, like you said, and through writing as well. So through writing the blog, I started writing the blog really just as a hobby, because working full time, and when you have your own business, and you might, you know, feel like this as well, it was really hard to take some time out. If I took time out, I felt guilty about it. I just felt like I wasn't parenting very well, and I just was letting people down at work. A lot of this pressure I was putting on myself. And so I Googled mum guilt one day, this is like 2016 time, and then nothing came up. And I just thought that was really interesting, that there was hardly any information on this feeling, this overwhelming feeling that I had of feeling guilty. So I'd said to my husband as a joke that I was going to start blogging as Guilty Mother, which he thought was quite a funny name. And it is Guilty Mother, and it's about turning it on its head, because I'm about positivity, and it was about helping women to not feel so guilty and let that feeling like a wave just sort of come over you. But equally, the reason why you feel that is because you care so much and you just want to do a really great job. But there's just so much, I think, sometimes in the press or in what we see about this perfect parenting. And, psychologically, it puts a lot of pressure on us, and we just don't need it. Imperfect parenting is where it is. And actually, somebody someday just needs to know, or someone just to walk up to say, you're doing a really great job. Don't worry if you're dropping a few balls, because I feel exactly the same. And to tell that to another parent, particularly a mother, can make them feel so much better, because it just seems like everyone else around you has got it all figured out. And the juggle is real, and the guilt is an emotion. I mean, it can feel like a bit of a useless emotion, because it doesn't do anything other than and sort of eat you up inside. So I actually don't feel that guilty so much anymore. Don't worry, I do have my moments, but I haven't written on the blog for about a year and a half, but I still love writing about so many different topics. And obviously the blog's really evolved, whether it's travel, entrepreneurship, helping young women. So, I don't talk about guilt, but that was the reason I started. And I used it as such a cathartic way to talk about how I was feeling. And I think it was very relatable. And even now, some 50,000 people followed the blog, but I only started it as an outlet really for myself. But yeah, I think it really hit a nerve with lots of women in a really positive way.
Yeah. I mean, your point about it is particularly women, and we'll talk about that in a minute. You know, this idea that when we become moms, we just want to do our very best, but we just constantly find ourselves feeling that it's never good enough. It's never enough. We're not giving enough time. We're not giving enough resources. We're not giving enough energy and vitality to it. And actually, the children, it's so funny that, there's this real kind of inverse relationship between how much effort you think you need to put in and their happiness. When actually, it's a bit like that, analogy or this story of, buying presents for children, whether it's their birthday or Christmas, and like you buy all these extravagant expensive presents and they're just not that bothered, are they? You think that they're going to be delighted, and they are delighted when they open them, but then they're just like messing around with like the wrapping paper or the boxes that the gifts have come in, which I think is a perfect analogy for parenting, because I think we always feel that we've got to overdo it and push ourselves to the brink, and in addition to neglect ourselves to the point of sickness in lots of cases, feeling like, unless you're completely depleted, that you are not giving your best. You've got to give it everything that you've got. But when we consider all of the other hats that we have to wear, we have to give ourselves way more grace than we do. And it's an easy thing for me to say, and it's obviously hard to do, because I'm exactly the same, exactly as you've described, running your own business, being a mom, trying to explore some of my own creative outlets as well, and also just taking time off. The idea of unplugging now, even that the fact that an entire industry has been created from unplugging or self-care, is wild to me, because when I look at like my grandmother, who's one of my biggest inspirations, she never felt guilty for taking herself to a spa or like booking a massage or booking a facial. She's such an inspiration in that particular sense, amongst many other things, because, as a mother of five and working and trying to do all of these different things, she would have been the epitome of how on earth are you making all of this work? And so she never felt guilty at all. And I think that just comes from this idea that, well, if I don't work, if I'm broken, the rest of the family doesn't work. Nothing else can function effectively. And I think there is something in that we can quite often miss, that we have to make sure that we are optimizing our own well-being, which, now is a buzzword. But really, it's such an important part. It's a critical part of our existence as moms, especially, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. We've put ourselves at the bottom of the pile for so long, and a lot of us have been really suffering burnout. And where I am in my life cycle at the moment is very different to the 35-year-old woman that I was, probably a bit unwell, obsessive about work, just way, way too much. But now I don't feel guilty if I need to take time out. I go to the gym 4 times a week. Sometimes my daughter comes with me, and I want to be a role model for her. I want her seeing me training. And I'm, I'm an amateur power lifter now. And I want her to watch me being strong. And actually, if there's one thing that I've learned, I say I've only been a parent for 30, nearly 14 years. But if there's one thing I've learned that any child needs or wants, money can't buy it. They just want your time. And actually, some of the best conversations I have with my children, my sons or my daughter, it was when I pick them up in the car. Sometimes I pick up my daughter first because she's about 20 minutes away from the boys' school. And we'll get that time in the car and let her decompress about her day, whether it's positive, whether it's negative, whether it's neutral, whether she doesn't want to talk. And I'll not ask her too many questions. I'll just enjoy the silence until she speaks and let her use her voice. We're very used to, as parents, telling our children what to do, because that's just sort of how we've all been wired, because we were all told what to do. So we're just passing it down the line. But there is some real beauty in silence that I've begun to enjoy, whether I'm walking with the children and not saying anything, and all of a sudden she'll say something like, oh, so-and-so is being really difficult at school. I'm like, oh, okay. You want to talk about that? And they'll open up, but it could take 15, 20 minutes for that conversation to prise open. And we're just so used to speaking about all sorts of things and just trying to navigate everything and do stuff on time. But my grandfather always told me that, you know, we've got two ears and one mouth for a reason. We should be doing twice as much listening as we do talking. And yeah, I think if we can, our kids do want to be heard, and giving them time, even if it's 20 minutes, I think is really, really precious.
Yeah, I love that. I have a similar relationship with my two, and exactly as you describe, I'm having to unlearn some of these habits, some of the behaviours around making them feel that they're being interrogated. So, you know, wanting to have a gentle conversation with them, or maybe detecting that something's not quite right in their body language or behavior, or, you know, that after school conversation is so critically important to me. I remember when I worked in the city before I worked for myself, and I was never really able, probably three times a week, I was able to collect Sophia from school. And I missed the other 2 days so much. I really missed that time, because even when she was 4 or 5 or 6, there were so many things that would come up in the conversation, you know, however big or small, what she ate for lunch at school, who played with her, who didn't play with her, what she enjoyed, what the teacher said to her, how she felt. It's, you know, the feelings that she had, and maybe not necessarily sure how to articulate them. But sometimes in the midst of chaos, she might be describing, oh, you know, today we had fish fingers and beans for lunch, and also my friend didn't talk to me today. And then we played in the playgrounds. And then I'm thinking, oh my gosh, there are so many different messages that you're telling me in this one statement. And you just have to listen, exactly as you describe. You have to listen to what they're saying and pick up on these clues. But it's really important that we're able to give them the breathing space without imposing this kind of, you know, this kind of helicopter parenting of, I need you to tell me straight away so that I can fix the problem for you. Because sometimes we can't fix it, which is excruciating. But I think giving ourselves giving them the breathing space to just communicate in a way that feels comfortable for them, and listening without necessarily reacting, without necessarily trying to give a solution, is such a powerful parenting tool.
I think that's what I love about walking as well, because when I was originally writing the book and talking about conversations I used to have with my daughter at the kitchen table, if she's sitting opposite me, sometimes it feels like she's being interviewed, you know, and it can feel quite formal. But when you're walking, if you're side by side, it's that occasion where you're completely neutral, and you also, there's no eye contact in a really positive way. So, you know, it allows them at that point to feel like they are completely impartial and neutral with you, not being interrogated over the table about what they had for lunch. I don't know why we're absolutely so interested by what they had for lunch. I do it all the time. I don't know why. Does it matter?
I don't know.
No one asks me what I have for lunch. I don't know.
No, but in my family, we're obsessed with it to this day. Like, if I speak to my mom or my grand, they'll go, oh, what did you have for dinner? And I'm like, Mom, why are you asking me that? And then I'll give her a rundown. My sister does it as well. We're obsessed. And we send pictures of food all the time. Like, we're obsessed. I don't know. I don't think that's a habit that we can ever shake off in my family. So I suppose just continuing that thread then, and thinking about, you know, this next generation of girls, how do we get them to, I don't want to say ditch the guilt, but how do we get them into a position where they're unapologetic in, you know, what they're doing, what they're feeling, not feeling that they have to shrink? I mean, based on your, you know, your experiences as a parent, but also just as a woman, Are there particular techniques? Are there things that we should be saying to them, affirming in them, whether you're a parent, whether you're a mentor, aunt, uncle, you know, father? What kinds of things could we be saying to this next generation of young women in particular? Because we know that there is a challenge with young women around self-esteem, body confidence, general life and career confidence. So, yeah.
Oh, there's so much that I want to say to our younger generation. I think one of the first things for my daughter and other girls would be, you know, around this self-esteem is a huge thing, because how you find your sense of self and the things that you really enjoy, a lot of it comes from having self-esteem and the confidence to give stuff a try. So a lot of it will start with not being afraid to fail, just try something. And because of this big issue that we have in the world about messing up or failure, which is, you know, all of us can touch on points where we failed something, and it's got such a negative attitude with failure. But actually, you know, as I've taught my daughter, it means, you know, first attempt in learning. First attempt.
Love that. First attempt in learning. Boom. That's
so
a power acronym.
You're just trying something for the first time. So I've failed many things over the years. And actually, as adults, we don't tell our children that enough. And what sometimes children see is they see people being successful. Your children will look at you and think, my mum is successful in her work, in what she does. But how often do we sit down and actually tell them the journey of how we got there? Because we know it wasn't linear. It is not. It's been, you've been turned down for stuff, you know, people might have been made redundant, but it's led on to something else, which was even more exciting. And, you know, all of these steps in our journey are critical, but children, I think, really need to hear it, particularly, I think, young girls, because they don't always want to try stuff because of this huge fear of failure or messing up. There's obviously been a real line of pressure for girls to perform well at school and ace all their grades. And I really like to praise effort over anything else. And I think, you know, what does good grades look like? And I think, you know, as somebody that did okay in their GCSEs, but I didn't do my A-levels, I didn't go to university, it doesn't mean that I'm not successful in my own right. But I think praising effort over everything else is really, really important. And that's all I'll ever ask for my children, is to do their very best, whatever their personal best is. And giving stuff a try, I think, is huge. And you know, when we get stuff wrong, even if you're doing spellings with your child at home, and we're very good at saying, well, that's wrong, or people put lines through it. And again, it's like you're breaking down their self-esteem every time. But, you know, I wrote in the book, somebody told me about the power of not yet. So it's not right yet. I really, really like that. And even if I'm doing something myself and it doesn't seem right, it's not right yet, but it will be, and you will get there. And, you know, just keep having these sort of positive messages of how you get from A to B, and don't worry if the journey doesn't go as you think it's going to go, because that's okay. And the more we share those sort of stories with our young, inspiring girls is really important. The other big thing is something that obviously I did when I went into business with my brother, which is just one of the simplest things to do, is raising your hand. And one of the reasons why we don't have so many women in, you know, maybe middle management or senior management, is because we're not always raising our hands to take an opportunity, because we're already worried that somebody else is probably more qualified than me, or they might be better than me. So they're not always raising their hand. There might be other reasons why they're not raising their hand, but when we talk about gender equality and women having their seat at the table, if we're not raising our hands from the age of sort of 6 or 7 years old, we've not been conditioned to raise our hands. And we're so worried that someone's going to call us out, or we don't raise our hand in a conference because we think, oh, that's just, you know, I'm not going to say that out loud, because it what? And then somebody in front of you says exactly the same thing that you were going to say, and you're like, oh, you know. And it happens all the time, whether you're 7 or 37 or 47. It's, we can all relate to that. But from our young girls raising their hand more, I mean, I get told off by teachers sometimes. They say, Joe, can you stop telling everybody to put their hands up in class, because it's actually quite disruptive. I know, but it doesn't matter. It can be a virtual hand. It's not always, doesn't need to be a physical hand. I'm just saying our young girls in class need to take an opportunity, and they don't need to be afraid if they've got it wrong, because it is the power of not yet. Or if they've got it wrong, that's fine. You can try again. But putting your hand up, whether you want to decide that you want to go and play cricket, whether you want to go and do that creative class that you wasn't sure if you wanted to do or not, or whether you want to go on the rugby pitch or football pitch or whatever it is that you want to try, don't worry about failing it. Just worry about seeing, you know, try it out and see if you enjoy it, because you never know where it might go. You never know where it might lead. So, you know, that is sort of relatable for all children, but I think particularly for girls, this fear of the failure and perfectionism is very rife in our young girls, which is one of the reasons why I wrote the book. I would hope really the book wasn't needed, but it is needed, because I was reading over and over again mental health of our young people is in a pretty dire position at the moment, and children are waiting years to be seen, which is really, really sad. But for our young girls, the self-harm and the pictures of themselves that they're so concerned about, with the lack of self-esteem, the campaigns that Dove have been doing are, you know, very, very real. And the work I've done with Girl Guiding and the Young Women's Trust meant that this book was needed. And this is why I had to write it first. I'd love to have an opportunity to write something for my boys, but this one had to come first. And I am a girl as well. So I wrote it through my own lens. So there's lots of work that I think we can do to try and support our young girls. And of course, social media seems to be a big influence for all young people, particularly for our young girls. And again, the issues of perfectionism is they have to think about how they can control what they see on their feed. If they don't like what they see, they're in control. Take it away or unfollow. You know, follow the stuff that makes you feel good. Surround yourself with people that lift you up, that you trust, that make you feel good about yourself. And we know who those people are now, because we know that the people that are in our lives are the people that lift us up, and they get us and they're there for us. So our young girls need to really think about who's surrounding them, who's their influence. And how are they influencing others as well? Because they're watching us all the time, which can put us under a lot of pressure. But I look at my daughter and, you know, she's really inspiring for me when I watch her do stuff that I would never do when I was her age. So, yeah, I hope she just keeps doing her. Just keep doing what's right for her, not what's right for me.
Yeah. I mean, everything that you said really chimes with me. I mean, when I think about writing Cash is Queen, and obviously it's a book about finance for girls, you know, young girls, young women. And again, it's probably similar to you, this tension between, you know, obviously everybody needs to learn about personal finance. Similarly, everybody needs to feel confident in themselves. But when you look at the various, you know, we don't have to go into the stats, but when you look at the stats when it comes to women's finances in general on a global scale, I wish Cash is Queen didn't have to be written, actually, but it does, because there are still today women that are struggling financially, that don't have the right tools, that feel completely unconfident, they feel ignored, they feel excluded by the financial services industry. But then more broadly, there are some societal pressures around women's almost entitlement to feel that they have access to building wealth. You know, I'm sure you've got many stories that you could share, which is probably an entirely different podcast, around, you know, when you enter into boardrooms and when you're negotiating contracts, or when, you know, you being a senior leader in the tech industry with all of your years of experience, and of course, working alongside your brother, it'd be interesting to understand, you know, some of the dynamics there in terms of who are they looking to when you enter into some of those meetings where something might be under your remit, but they maybe are looking at your brother because they assume that he has to be the person that's managing the money or whatever the case may be. And so from my perspective in writing Cash is Queen, it was looking at it and saying, as a mother of daughters, as a woman yourself, what are some of the lessons that you think are important for 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old girls to understand about their finances, to understand about the influence other people can have on their relationship with money, where some of those feelings about money come from, how they can manage some of those habits, and more importantly, how they can conduct themselves, how they can, you know, have a really positive relationship with money. You know, we talk about having a royal money mindset, and it, you know, it chimes very nicely with your idea of feeling that, you know, it's okay to have a voice. You have to raise your hand. But, you know, as you were speaking, I thought to myself, there is a massive role that society plays here in terms of how we view those women, how we view the women that are building wealth, how we view the women that are raising their hands consistently. I went to a girls' school, so I know the girls in class that were raising their hand for every single question, or were interrupting the teacher to say, "Miss, what do you think about this or that?" You know, we would look at them like, "Oh my gosh, you're so extra," or "Why can't you be quiet?" or "Why are you so overconfident?" And, you know, when I think about one of those girls in particular who's now gone on to, you know, build a really successful business, and I think she had all of those ingredients and attributes when we were 11 years old. I don't know where they came from in her, but she was completely unbothered by us rolling our eyes or sighing whenever she raised her hand. That's what we really want with the young girls. But I recognize that, you know, in a way that men are not viewed through that lens, we do it to one another as women quite often, but it's not just us. Of course, there's a broader societal issue, as I say. How do you think we can dismantle and tackle some of that, you know, more broadly? It's like quite a big question, but you know what I mean? Like the way that we view women and girls that are putting themselves forward, how can we stop viewing them as bullshit? A number of different women in leadership and in business have talked about this very subject.
I think that is a tough subject. And like you say, that could be a whole conversational piece of its own. But it's really interesting that you recognise that one particular person of just being very confident in her own self. But is there an element of like attention seeking or not? I mean, there could be lots of different layers that you could uncover there. I don't know. Some people just like the recognition that the answer's correct or they're doing the right thing, and it can be very, very straight. So the teacher might say, yes, that is correct. But, you know, she doesn't have to keep putting her hand up. But some people just like to know that it's right. And that, again, a lot of it comes from our parenting. She could have that in the home where she feels under pressure to perform and to get things correct. I really admire so many women that have been really successful. I know lots of women that have been successful, but also were very quiet and shy at school. A couple of the people in my book, and like June and Anna. June talks about, you know, when she was at school, she was very, very quiet and very shy. And it's taken her a long time to get to where she is now, you know, successfully, financially. And then Anna, which is Mother Pucker, she, you know, she talks about how she didn't have a voice really at all. And there's lots of things I think she should have used her voice for, but didn't. And then ends up doing the Flexapil and talking in Trafalgar Square with a megaphone. So you go from, but a lot of people talk about when they were younger, they did feel quite shy and didn't feel confident enough raising their hand in class. But I think if we can raise our girls to look at these women with fondness and admiration, and thinking, don't think that they've just come out as the whole, as the full package. It's been a year of these building blocks to get to where they are now, and that the confidence journey isn't a short one. It's actually quite a long one. So don't worry if you don't have it all figured out. But you know, helping girls and women to have a really healthy relationship with money is important. And I think you can start from quite a young age. I remember taking my daughter to the bank last year to open her first bank account. That felt like a very grown-up thing to do. We actually bypassed the Go Henry type scenario. And we went straight to the bank and we had a meeting within a bank with a bank manager. And with Erin, and she had to do her signature. And she's like, I don't have one. Obviously, I was like, this is the time. You are opening a bank account, your very first bank account. And you're going to have a card, and she's got the app, and she can control her spending. She can see how she spends her money. She gets her monthly allowance. And I think it allows them to practice a healthy relationship with money. And she can see how that money is being spent. And when she gets her next amount coming in, or she can, you know, she can budget if she wants to save up for something. And I think from 13 years old, it gives her a healthy relationship of money. And, you know, she sees how hard my husband and I work. We both work full time. My husband's in the city full time, working in the construction sector, which is pretty tough. And we want to go on nice holidays. We want to go skiing and we'll do things. Well, where do you think that all comes from? We work really hard. And I hope all three of my children recognize that work ethic of, you know, work hard, but we also we want to have an enjoyable life and we want to go on nice holidays, but we will work for that and we will save. In the fact that she's saving on her little app and using her bank account, we're pretty much doing the same thing but on a bigger scale, and just having those healthy conversations about money and finances with them from a young age, really, of how they use their money.
I love that so much. I mean, for anybody listening, I'm absolutely beaming all the way through as Jo was describing. I mean, first of all, I have to say, I was a little bit like, wow, there are actual bank managers that exist that you can sit down with.
Well,
that's
yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, it was. So the branch was still open. I don't know if it's open now.
So that's like a breaking news thing. But also, I feel like we almost have to sound a klaxon for like that. That's a real milestone in, you know, a young person's life, going and having a bank account set up. It's in your name. You're the person that controls it. You have your own signature. All of those things are huge. I mean, they are amazing memories. I mean, I remember going with my gran to go and open my Abbey National, as it was then known. For anybody listening, Abbey National is now Santander, just saying. But Abbey National Building Society, going and having a little passbook, and they would write down my deposit. And I still have that little passbook today. I mean, that was my first introduction to, you know, getting your pocket money, saving your money, spending your money, and some of the lessons, the life lessons that you learn about managing your own money. And, you know, of course, you know, I'm all over that. I love it. I love it so much. And, you know, trying to make sure that the next generation have really positive habits around money. But also, it's not just about this kind of punitive, you've got to save everything you earn and never find the space to enjoy your money. The healthiness in the relationship comes from knowing when to save and knowing when to spend, being clear about what you're saving and spending for. And I love the example that, you know, you describe of you and your husband. I guess you're living it. You're modeling that behavior. You know, the two of you work. And of course, it doesn't look the same in every household, but the two of you are working full time, earning money, but making sure that the children are aware of the fact that the things that we love to do are fueled by the fact that we work so hard. So is that relationship between the effort and the reward that comes? But I suppose now is a good opportunity for us to kind of segue into your relationship with money, Joe. You said something at the start of the conversation around, you know, what children need and the fact that, you know, the one thing that they really need from us is something that money can't buy, and it's our time. And I always think, you know, in the conversation about money and happiness, does money buy happiness? I think, and I it'd be good to get your thoughts on it. I wonder whether at times the conversation can become quite warped. The narrative can become quite warped by people. If you think about those people that exist at the lower end of the income spectrum, that are struggling and struggling, working incredibly hard, but not really seeing the outputs of their labor, at least not in an economic sense. And so just not in a position to give the time. But from their perspective, of course, they're viewing it as, well, if I had more money, that would directly contribute towards our level of happiness within this home, because, you know, even in your example, that frees up more of my time. So, you know, in this conversation, this discourse around money buying happiness, what's your view on it?
Oh, I do think that's such a tricky question, because I think money pressures, like you say, across all levels are really, really tough, and they're definitely out there. I mean, look at the cost of living crisis at the moment, and you know, it really upsets me that there's families out there that are just struggling to put food on the table for their children. Of course, that is going to affect their happiness. Of course, that's going to affect their relationships with their partner, with their relationship with their children, you know, and I don't know how to fix some of that. And I love that the Prince of Wales is making a real conscious effort to try and help with, you know, social housing and cost of living, and really trying to think about how he's going to make his mark on helping people like that. But, you know, I think we make our own world of happiness, and there's lots of things that we do that don't cost anything. And I know I talked about time, but I get happiness and fulfillment from my work, and, you know, but there's been some good years. There's been some awful years. I mean, the first 3 years of our business, I don't think we even turned a profit. And I think that was really, really tough, that I would go to my brother and I'd say, we'd work 6 days a week back then. I'd say, is there any money left to pay ourselves? And he said, no. And that was really hard. So I was living at home and working 6 days a week. But a lot of businesses don't turn a profit in the first 3 years. And I don't know how many people know that. Some businesses go a long time without being profitable, which is a real concern. And we've had seen some huge brands, you know, sink ship because just either being poorly managed or just not profitable. And no matter whether your business is big or small, you know, they say what turnover is vanity, profit is sanity. We all have to make money. And whether you're making 20 quid or 200,000, it can feel very fulfilling when you know how that money has been created. I doubt I've made much money from my book. And actually, someone said to me, you don't tend to write a book for money unless you're sort of J.K. Rowling type of realm, which unfortunately I'm not. But I didn't write my book to make money, and I didn't write my blog to make money. But they're both very fulfilling for my own happiness, and they still make me incredibly proud. But so money is always a very, very difficult subject. And actually, women aren't very good at talking about money. And even when you're with my speaking work and you're thinking, we keep telling our children, know your worth, you know, and I think, well, how much do I charge to speak in a school? How much do I charge for this? How much do I charge for that? Am I underselling myself? It's really, really hard. And there's been quite a lot on LinkedIn from some of my friends recently saying, I'm going to put my price out there. And if you don't like it, well, then, you know, don't book me. But this is what I charge. And, you know, I do a number of free talks per year to schools. And I think that's the right thing to do. But in general, I think, yeah, if you find a number that works for you and that feels right. But yeah, I don't think we should keep undervaluing ourselves all the time.
No, I love that you've ended your response with that topic of know your worth, because it's something, I mean, it's something that we discuss all the time within the Rainmaker community. And I think even that conversation can be quite warped, because what exactly, you know, if you're thinking about it, I mean, in theory, all of us are worth $1 million. We are priceless. But then in real terms, what does that mean? How do you make sure that you are being paid appropriately for your industry, for your years of experience, your qualifications, all of those things? And you're quite right, as you know, and you mentioned something earlier about, you know, how few of us are putting ourselves forward if we feel that we haven't ticked every single box on a job spec, for example, because we think we are not worthy of that opportunity. And a similar thing translates, you know, carries its way through if you're a business owner thinking, oh gosh, I'm a bit nervous to raise my prices. What if I lose all of my customers? And there's this constant tension between making sure that exactly as you described, that your business is profitable and can survive, but also making sure that, you know, I don't want to be viewed as greedy, you know. And again, it comes back to the societal pressures that we face as women. And I remember working in the city, the few women that were in senior leadership positions working in finance, they had terrible reputations. And actually, when you got to know them, they were lovely. In my experience of the vast majority of those women, they were all lovely, but they had to almost put on this armor of invincibility every day. And I imagine them having to take it off on the train before they get into the house, but they have to put this armor on every day so that they're almost impenetrable when they are facing the criticism, the snide comments and everything else that goes along with being a senior woman in an industry in which women are really poorly represented. Even to this day, it's improved within finance and it's improved within tech, but it's still nowhere near where it could be. So yeah, brilliant response to that question. But what about your personal relationship with money, Joe? You've described, you know, building your business, and I'm sure there are lots of entrepreneurs listening that can attest and, you know, relate to that experience of, oh God, this business isn't making money. Is it viable? How much longer can I go without being paid? And of course, you know, that lovely example that you shared of taking your daughter to open her first bank account, which is really amazing. And so you, obviously you're starting her off on her personal journey of, you know, how she interacts with money. But how would you describe yours, and how would you say it's evolved over time?
So I would say, because I'm sort of self-taught, so even having wealth from quite a young age, you know, I think I was quite well advised in many respects. I don't think I've made too many poor decisions with money, but driving Porsches and flash cars from around 22 years old, because we were quite wealthy young entrepreneurs. I bought my first house when I was 21 years old, and so very looking back at it, I don't talk about it very often and don't think about it, but by the time my friends were in their 30s, they were like trying to get on the housing ladder, and obviously it was just so difficult, and the deposit, and but I'd put everything into this property at 21 years old. I didn't have much money left because it was all in the bricks and mortar, so I said to my friends, you have to come round to mine, I've got any money to go out, but I have got a house. So that actually, there's two ways of looking at that. I felt like I didn't want to miss out because my friends were going out enjoying the town, and I'd got myself a mortgage, which is proper grown up at 21. But, you know, as you could probably imagine, I sold that property years later, made a huge profit on it, and then used that profit to flip onto the next property and the next property from there. So, you know, I have made some good financial decisions and enjoyed wealth from a younger age. And, you know, I think as I've got older, I'm much, much better at managing my finances. We have lots of Excel spreadsheets, even at home, with how we budget things. I think that's really important. And if there's one huge piece of advice I would give to anybody who's an entrepreneur or thinking of starting their own business, always budget for tax in advance and make sure you're always putting money aside for tax. It always seems to sneak up on people. There are lots of conversations I have with friends. So just always make sure you're budgeting and putting money aside for that. And make sure you're budgeting for what you want to do throughout the year. You know, there are holidays or aspirations that you want to do, even if it's in the UK or abroad, just make sure you're budgeting for all the things that you want to do and enjoy, as well as, you know, all of the increased overheads for your business. There's always so much to do. You know, cash flow is king. If you've got money, you can make money. But, you know, if you're struggling, nobody seems to want to lend you anything. And obviously, lending is really, really tough at the moment. So you have to be quite smart in thinking about how you can generate money in order to make money.
Yeah, I love that. Love that, Jo. I'm so inspired by that because, you know, to be a young woman, I mean, there are so many... so many doors that you just smashed down, you know, as a young woman, and perhaps unwittingly, because we weren't talking about it in the same way then as we do now, in terms of, you know, having, you know, inspiring women in the public eye and, you know, sharing these stories and backgrounds and experiences. But, you know, you were effectively having to learn on the job. You were just learning as you went along, whether it came to managing your finances, investing in property, you know, doing up your house, whatever it was. And even, you know, having to be, you know, almost kind of effectively being an outlier in your group of friends, having to be somebody that was doing things differently from everybody else, and just not ever diminishing yourself in that process. It doesn't mean that there weren't wobbles. I'm sure, you know, everybody has those wobbles, but, you know, just always being somebody that's a bit of a pioneer in terms of how you did things, which I absolutely love. I mean, that's something that's shone through throughout this conversation. So I suppose my final question then, before we get onto our quickfire round, is I'm very interested in this because obviously this is a theme that runs through, you know, the work that I do with Raincheck in helping women, you know, build sustainable long-term wealth. But of course, one of the things that we can quite often miss is that when we think about investing, when we talk about investing, we individually are our biggest assets by far. And we don't always think of ourselves as assets. When we think of assets, we're thinking, you know, our investment portfolios, our property portfolios. But of course, everything that we pour into ourselves enables us to be our best selves and to go out and make the money that is going to enable us to build that tangible wealth. So from your perspective, Jo, what would you say has been your biggest investment in yourself, and how would you say it's shaped or transformed you?
Biggest investment in myself, I would say giving myself the headspace to grow into my own sense of self. And I know that sounds like quite an easy thing to say, but I think like you were talking about with people, women in the financial sector, I think for a long time I had, you know, my work Joe and my personal Joe, my home Joe, were sort of almost like two different people. But actually, I think it takes quite a long time and the confidence to actually just be one person. And sometimes in the past, particularly working in the tech industry, I almost felt like I needed to act more like a man to be a good boss. And I'm not sure if that was actually the right thing to do, and actually if that really felt like my true self. Although the business was successful even back then, whether it was 15 years ago, I think the work Joe and the home Joe almost were like two separate people. But I have become my whole self, and I'm not afraid to say yes to things. I'm not afraid to say no, and I think understanding the power of no is really, really important. And maybe we don't say that enough, very politely if you want to, but we don't always have to do what you don't want to do. Or if you can't commit to something, that's also okay. As well as just understanding that sort of true sense of self and bringing your whole person to work. And that's very much talked about at the moment, is people feeling very comfortable bringing their whole sense of self to work and being able to share their personality at work, and not feeling like they're two different people, or necessarily feeling like you need to be really, really bossy to be a good boss. So, you know, we all talk about empathetic leaders, and I'd like to think that I am, and actually I'm a caring person, and I really care about my staff and my people, and I give them a lot more of my time than maybe I did in the past, because I was so wrapped up with winning business or deals or clients. But actually I spend a lot more time now, I think, with my team, and that's been really, really fulfilling for me. And just building that really, really great network around me. And also an amazing network of people that I meet through networking clubs or at the Albright in Mayfair, or just women like yourselves. Just meeting amazing women that we can do good business together just by opening a conversation and thinking, I like you. I like what you're about. And we do that, I think we do that a lot more than maybe we used to maybe 10, 15 years ago. I think it's been really, really empowering for me that we don't see each other as competition. We actually see each other as allies and saying, how can I help you? And I think that's one of the biggest things that I love to say to another woman. And I did it on a call this morning when she was saying, I want to introduce you to so-and-so about a particular thing I was trying to plug. And I went, well, how can I help you? What can I do for you? Tell me one thing I can do for you. How often do we do that for each other? I think we could do that a bit more.
I love that, Jo. What a beautiful mic drop moment to end the conversation. So do we have 60 seconds to do our quick fire three questions at random?
Go for it.
First answer that comes to your mind.
Oh, God.
So what's one money lesson you learned early on that you swear by?
To budget for tax. I think that's probably an important one. Yeah.
It is an important one. I'm glad that you reiterated that point for people like me. If money is no object, what are you blowing the budget on?
I need a new extension.
So okay.
That's quite Love big that. Money. Yeah. Maybe mm-hmm. two extensions, depending on how much money is available.
And then final question, complete this sentence. Anyone that knows me would be surprised that secretly I am what?
An amateur powerlifter.
Yeah, I was surprised when you said that.
Yeah,
amazing.
I lifted 120 Love kilos. That. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Bloody hell. Yeah, that's amazing. That's a really good one. Jo, I've loved this conversation so much. Thank you so much for your time. Where can people find you, work with you, follow you, find out more?
Oh, thank you so much. So I've got two accounts on Instagram. I'm at Jo Wimble Groves and I'm also at The Rise of the Girl. So go follow both of them if you'd like. The blog is builtymother.co.uk and you can also find information on there if you are interested in me speaking in a school or a university or in your business. If you've got a women in leadership group, would just love to do anything like that. And I'm also on LinkedIn. So LinkedIn's really great. So just come find me on LinkedIn. Yeah. Let's chat.
Amazing. Amazing. And as I just to repeat again, Rise of the Girl is a really brilliant book. So buy it for your nieces, daughters, granddaughters, goddaughters, all the girls in your family. It's really worthwhile. Or for anybody that is raising girls and contributing to raising girls in any way. A fantastic resource. So, Jo, thank you again. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck and don't forget to share, like, rate, review and subscribe. See you next time.